Hi, I'm Dr. Drew, and this is Dr. Drew After Dark. Please be advised that Dr. Drew After Dark may contain sexually oriented content and be unsuitable for young children. And welcome to another glorious episode of Dr. Drew After Dark. We've been doing this now for a few episodes. You got a taste of what this thing is supposed to be. All I know, I hope Christina and Tom are happy with this because it was their brainchild. And I spend most of my time ashamed with my hands over my face. And that's the nature of this show. But tell us what you like and don't like. Send it into drdrewafterdark@gmail.com. Also, let us know your... send us your questions. We get to those always on every episode. Your few, and you know, it's like the ones that are coming your way in a few moments, like sweaty pits and stretching your dong and dating a formerly dead fetus. Those are questions that are coming soon. Also, send your voice messages finally to 818-253-1693. That voice here is the great Chris Hardwick.
Hello. It's nice to be, you know, I'm so excited to do this because this is the most... I don't know, synonymous experience to when we used to host Loveline.
That's exactly right. This is the closest thing.
I worked at K-Rock. I did the overnight shift in Los Angeles. And whenever Carolla would go out of town, I would fill in.
Yes.
And those were really great memories.
Yes, they were.
And this is fun.
You and I, it's a point being you and I have known each other for 25, 30?
25 30, years. 30, yeah. 20, I think it's 25.
I think it's 94 or something.
94, yeah, 25. Yeah, yeah. Exactly 25.
Yeah, 25 years.
That's a big number. I was an adult back then, too. Oh.
Well, so we'll see about that.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll find out.
Well, back to Christina and Bob. One of the reasons this show came about is Christina's fascinated by comedians and what makes their heads tick. And
sure.
So she asked me to start digging in a little
sure,
bit.
Sure, 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 sure.
So that's what we're going to do today. Why go to comedy? Why you did that? What does it do for you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And but let's go back to our relationship. So we used to do Loveline together, and you used to come on the TV show. Remember that?
I came on the Loveline TV show.
Because I don't know if people remember this piece of your history was Singled Out.
That's right. And the TV show was MTV. Singled Out was MTV. And I did Singled Out from 94 to 98, which was a very long time in the life of a daily MTV show.
Oh, my God.
And
that's where Jenny McCarthy came from.
That's Jenny came out of that. Mm-hmm. And and it was a fun, surreal experience that. And then people come up to me and they'll go, I remember Singled Out. And I'm like, I sort of remember it. You know, like I have snapshots of it in my head.
Well, so you went through the Nerdist.
Yep.
And then now what are we doing?
Now I left the company last year or early last year and just decided to, you know, that I liked the idea of like building my own thing again.
You are incredibly good at. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. Mm. I mean, I always don't you always feel like, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing, but I get really jazzed in the building of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the other company, I didn't own it anymore. It was bought by a much bigger company years ago. And so it just sort of felt like, I think I'm ready to like try my own stuff.
You're like a serial entrepreneur.
Well, but that's really what a comedian is. Like when you're a comedian, every comedian is an entrepreneur because you are responsible for all your own stuff.
You're the product.
You're the pitch man to the audience
first you have to pitch the organization, the distribution system.
Yes.
And then you pitch the audience.
Yeah, you do pitch the audience. You're your own marketer. You're your own. You do all of it. And so all comedians are inherently entrepreneurial.
Interesting.
Because
I thought they were just alcoholics.
So are a lot of entrepreneurs and CEOs.
That's true. Though they're drug addicts mostly.
And it's so you really are, a comedian is really sort of the CEO of their own career. Because they don't really have to rely on, I mean, obviously they'll have representatives and they'll have people that work for them, but you know, you're it. And so I love that idea. And I love, you know, sobriety for me was all getting sober 16 years ago, 16, what year is this? Yeah. 16
Good
years
for
ago
you.
Is all of, and you were helpful in that. And so I will always be indebted to you for that.
It's one of my great privileges.
I appreciate it. And so you know, like being able to take responsibility for all of your own stuff is kind of, I think what you, when you start discovering sobriety, it's like, oh yeah, I don't want to take responsibility. And that's why I'm addicted to stuff. So I like the responsibility.
Well, not only that, you really grabbed onto therapy. You're a good therapy subject.
I do like it.
And you got a lot out of it.
I did.
Do you feel like, and maybe you could talk about what it did for you that allowed you to actualize this part of yourself? Because you were not that way before.
No. And I think actualization is actually the perfect term, because I think, you know, the insidious thing about things like anxiety or depression is that
you don't have those things, do you?
What? I mean,
you're a comedian.
I mean, come on. But the thing about anxiety and depression is that it's so insidious because it can mimic so many things and it can trick you into thinking things are real that aren't. And
that's
so
a really interesting point that very few people talk about. Is how negative your thinking becomes, how negative your perceptions of others becomes when you're in these states.
Yes, and I think therapy helps you create some space between you and your internal monologue, because I think most people assume that if they're having an internal monologue, it must be true because their brain is telling them that it's true.
Right, and there's nothing farther from the truth.
That's exactly right, and I find that even 16 years into sobriety that, because quitting something, a substance or whatever, doesn't fix your problems. It just clears the path so you can start discovering whatever your real issues are. Mm-hmm. And what I've really come to appreciate is that I'm still learning things all these years later. It's like, oh, you know, am I seeking out a dramatic situation because it gives me that spike?
That high and low.
It's like,
which is, that's unique to addicts. They go for that.
Yeah.
And alcoholics do that.
Yeah. And so sort of learning, like,
when you're doing that, when you're not doing that,
it's a never ending process. But,
Christina would kill me if I didn't follow up with, so do you want to talk about your fundamental issues?
Well, I'm sure, you know, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I grew up under any like strange, crazy. It's just, you know, my parents divorced when I was 10 or 11. They did not have a great relationship. May I offer
something?
A lot. Sure.
And this is something just, I don't know where I'm going, but I know your mom. She's lovely.
She's great. Best. And my dad was great too.
Okay. I get empty set with your dad's. It's weird that I have I could call your mom. I know her. She's lovely.
The best. Yeah.
But I have no idea who your dad is.
My dad.
That there must be meaning in that.
Yeah. And so, you know, both my parents had interesting situations because my mom had not a great relationship with her mom and my dad had not a great relationship with his dad.
Interesting.
And I think there was some addiction in my mom's mom, although my mom doesn't seem to, there's no discernible expression of that I can see.
Now this is not, I don't know your dad, I'm not passing judgment on him, but the daughter of the alcoholic, usually if she doesn't get the gene, marries an alcoholic.
So my father was a drinker and
shocking.
He, there you go. It's almost like you know how this shit works, but my dad, you know, my dad was a kind of a career drinker, drank his whole life. Mm-hmm. In a time when, you know, again, he had a terrible relationship with his dad. He had some bad marriages. He lost sons. Like, he had real tragedy and trauma.
Yeah. Before your mom?
He lost a son before my mom. And then my mom gave birth prematurely. You know, I would have had a brother. Like, if my mom went through this pregnancy now, it would have survived. But this was 1973 or something.
But still, I mean, it's so, what's interesting to me is I'm like, I don't know your dad. I'm sitting in judgment of your dad. Like, why don't I know your dad? And then you go, oh yeah, he had all this horrible stuff.
He had all this horrible trauma.
This poor guy.
Yeah.
Of course I don't know your dad.
And there was a history of drinking in his family line.
The genetics.
My grandfather drank and had to quit at a certain point.
Irish, Welsh, Scottish.
They were, you know, like redneck hillbillies. So like they were of Irish, Northern English.
There you go.
Actually, Northern English, Scottish descent.
That'll do it.
And so, yeah, so all the hobo.
But I bet smart people.
I think
they tend to be very smart.
I think so. But I also, I didn't know, my cousins are all smart. They were all smart kids.
I'm not surprised.
So my dad, you know, he drank a lot when he was younger, probably to self-medicate. He definitely had some obsessive thinking tendencies. Mm-hmm. He definitely had that sort of fallacious catastrophizing thought process of if something good happens, something bad is going to happen. He definitely made negatively toxic connections in his, those were part of his, you know, habitual thinking. Mm. But his drinking definitely got less as he got older and he got more docile as he got older. But when he was younger, like, you know, like he just went through shit.
Is he with us still?
No, he died in 2013.
Okay.
And very suddenly died of a heart attack. Mm. And
was that hard for you?
It was terrible. Like, okay. I loved my dad and we were super close. And
weird that I have no sense of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I feel like I know you awfully well. And
well, there was a period of time where we, like, you know, the shitty thing about knowing someone for 25 years is that you might not talk to them for like 2 years. You know what I mean? Like, our lives are just so...
You're talking about you and me?
Yeah.
We didn't talk to each other for 15 years. I think we ran each other in the street in New York.
Oh, it was something like that. Yeah.
Something like that happened.
So, yeah. So, my dad died suddenly in 2013, and I adored him, and our relationship was great, and he was so sweet and wonderful, mm-hmm. and, you know, but...
Well, that's amazing.
Of ways to lose your parents, there was nothing left unsaid. There was nothing, great. You know, and he died very suddenly. And so...
That's great.
My next comedy...
I mean, not that he died.
Not that he died. You're like, no, it's great. But the really interesting thing was the comedy that I was doing around that time revolved around a lot of stories about him, and then he died. And so I went on stage like 3 days after the funeral to just talk about it. Mm. And it was so therapeutic. So my last comedy special, the through line was about losing my dad.
Mm. Just like Tig Notaro and breast cancer.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. And so as you... those are obviously two...
Tig, put on a list.
Those are actually obviously two different things to have to process.
Oh, very different. But again, this
but
is
processing
back to the,
tragedy.
Back to the comedic brain. I mean, that's what,
defense. It's a defense mechanism.
I don't think about. I think it more of as an acting out than a defense.
I think it's a defense mechanism because I think we have to. That making jokes about things help us not only deflect, but also feel like we're in control of the situation.
Okay.
Because you're able to, you know, I don't know, make jokes about it. But for me...
Is it distancing yourself from it with the funny?
It may be distancing, but it's also therapy. It's also talking about it on stage. Yeah. And what I loved being able to do is, you know, I had this kind of through line of being in Dead Dad Club, and other people who'd come to my shows would seem genuinely appreciative, like, oh, I've never heard anyone talk about it in this way before. Mm. So talking about it with respect, but also kind of like, fucking sucks, you know, like, but it's what happens. It's like that. And as we've talked about the mental health issues before, having normal conversations about them really helps kind of normalize the things that we have to go through in life.
Well, but I'm going to imagine, knowing you, that you may say he's an asshole, but I love, you know, his gratitude and forgiveness. It pervades some of the stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, but I didn't think of my, like, I love my dad. I never thought of him as an asshole.
He did some asshole stuff.
He did some asshole stuff when he was, you know, like, went through a midlife crisis around 40, and
he was being an asshole. I love him.
We didn't talk.
Same,
you know,
guy.
We didn't have a great relationship for a few years, but he came around. It all worked out okay.
I don't remember him at your wedding.
He was dead.
Oh, well, that's why I don't remember him there.
We thought it would be very awkward.
It would be weird if we were there.
Although, you know, like, Lydia did have zombie-themed wedding service. So, he could have fit in. Yeah. But I just didn't think, you know, exhuming him and shipping him to the wedding would
no,
be a thing
you.
We should do. But mm-hmm. but the interesting thing about that was Lydia... and we didn't know each other at the time, but her dad died a month after mine.
Oh.
And her dad died of a slow, horrible cancer that took his life over 8 years. And my dad died very suddenly. So our first date was all Dead Dad talk. And it was so refreshing to be able to connect with someone on a very real level and not like, so do you like Hawaii? You know, like it was such a real conversation and something that we, you know, bonded on very early on, because we both had different sides of this very, you know, shared experience.
And again, back to the role of comedy, what does it do for you up there? Did you always know you want to do comedy?
Always. I always knew I wanted to do it. I mean, my parents noticed, you know, like, because I was born in 71. So when SNL started, I was very young, but my parents saw that I just was transfixed, and they noticed right away that I became obsessed with Steve Martin.
Oh.
And so my parents, being the cool parents they were, started like, well, he likes this stuff. So they started giving me Steve Martin records, you know, like, they let me watch Richard Pryor. Like, they had no content restrictions really, as far as comedy went. And so they fed it. And my dad had a VHS player very early on, so he would record all the comedy specials. And I just
a little bit of porn,
devoured that Skinamax, just a little bit of Skinamax, just a little bit of Red Shoe Diaries.
But back to Pryor.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on him through the retrospectoscope, looking back at Pryor?
Well, one of the things that was so incredible, I mean, like, there were so many things that were so incredible about him, but especially when you kind of look at what the 80s comedy boom became, which is, the comedy boom, I think, really was from like 74 to like 92. There were 18 years of like comedy is king. Mm. And there were a million comedy shows on in the 80s, but they all started kind of bred because people were getting famous off of a Tonight One Tonight Show set. Yeah. So it was like people had sort of their quick identity, jokey jokes, whatever. There were a lot of great comics. And Pryor, you know, the magic of Pryor was that in the 70s, he was so autobiographical.
Yes.
And he talked about things.
Story,
you know, you're coming out of the 60s where everything's still squeaky clean. You're sort of coming out of the, you know, the Dick Van Dyke era, the Bewitched era, the I Love Lucy era. And so here's Richard Pryor. You have Richard Pryor. You have Norman Lear. You have Saturday Night Live. And it's almost this like punk rock movement in comedy where it's like we're talking about real shit. And Richard Pryor, he talked about his drug addiction. He talked about his heart attack. He talked about catching on fire.
I challenge anybody to go listen to this, not just his set, but go listen to his stories.
Yeah.
And the characters, Tulum and all that kind of stuff. And I'm going to tell you something. That's not just comedy. It's poetry.
It is poetry.
It's poetry.
It is poetry.
It is as relevant and powerful any moment you listen to it as when it was when he first did
and
it.
And so you look at all the super comics of the 70s and you see like, you know, Carlin was really kind of the like society's critic.
Yeah.
And Steve Martin, who I, you know, like he was my number one. His comedy was all about satire of comedy.
Yeah.
But it worked on two levels because if you didn't get that he was satirizing like a Vegas comic, they were still dopey funny bits.
Right.
And he wrote bits that were funny and you couldn't always necessarily explain why, but you were laughing. And, you know, I got to see him perform live when I was a kid. And so
have you read Born Standing?
Yeah. Standing Up. I listen to the audio version because he reads it.
Oh, wow.
So when he's talking about the old bits, he does them again.
Oh,
and
my
God. It's phenomenal. Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal.
I went to that theater at Knott's Berry Farm where he performed for many years.
Oh yeah,
right around the time he was there. I wonder if I saw him. It's
you,
so
you
weird.
Might have. Yeah,
I was
you,
in like
you might
junior
have.
high school or something, and I remember going there and I remember watching the melodramas that he talks about in that
book. It's very possible, but I also think, you know, from the standpoint of the comic, I think there's therapy and processing and defense mechanism. From the standpoint of the audience, a comedy show is I describe it as a flash community. You are basically setting up a community in an hour and a half and all coming together just for that moment.
Okay, so that's interesting. That's something I've not heard somebody say, but I think is right, which is you're creating connections with yourself and the audience and amongst the audience, right?
That's right.
It's like you become this flowing sea of people that are connected.
That's right.
And my question to you is, though, when you were depressed and whatever was going on there, what was different? What was missing? What was the problem?
You mean like when I was still drinking and stuff?
Yeah, what
was
the problem? You sort of hit a bottom somewhere. And what was that?
I don't know. It's just, you know, the thing that can be so, as you know, creepily insidious about addiction is that it's so progressive that it just happens before you even realize, because you start doing it when you're young and it's like, oh, it's fun. It's fun, 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 fun. At a certain point, it shifts to like, oh, this isn't just fun. Mm. You need to do this to survive. And you've set it up that way. And I don't know when that shift happened. I mean, I know that, you know, I was like the majority of my drinking. I mean, I drank a lot, but I did happen to be in New York during 9/11. And I kind of got stuck there.
Oh.
I was supposed to go back and forth. I was doing this ridiculous dating show called Shipmates, and I was supposed to fly back and forth to New York every other week to shoot the host wraps.
Uh-huh.
So I was on a plane at like an American Airlines LAX flight at JFK. And then the pilot came, we hadn't taken off, and the pilot came out and he said, I don't know how to say this, but two planes flew into the World Trade Center. And people didn't even have a frame of reference what that was.
Yeah, I remember how confused.
But I remember turning and looking out the window and seeing the billows of smoke. And that whole day was, I mean, like for everyone, you know, and I mean, obviously I don't think I need to set up how horrible. But what it meant was that I didn't travel back and forth to LA every other week. So I basically just stayed in New York and I was so, you know, I felt so displaced. I didn't really know anyone there. And so the thing that I had was that I just drank a lot because it, you know,
it was your only friend.
It was my, well, when you're drinking, you're controlling your feelings.
Yeah.
And so that for
well,
me,
I know you.
So that's where it really took off. Like the 2001 to 2003.
Here's my thing on you. I know you to be an extremely kind person and worried about everybody else, harsh on yourself.
Of course. I mean, so, of course, so I'm harsh on myself.
I'm imagining that something was going on where you were beating yourself up along that about that time, too.
I mean, listen, something. I'm sure that, like, if we're really digging back there, I'm sure there are things like, you know, when you see your parents argue a lot and you can't help and you don't, you know, it's like kids.
So shame and guilt.
We don't have the, like, our brains aren't formed to be able to process those big adult
things. But you leave those things with shame.
I guess so, shame. And we also, because we moved a lot, I was usually the new kid at school, so I was always trying to fit in.
Is that where the funny came in, too? Entertain the kids, be funny?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also because I got bullied a lot as a little kid because I was into, you know, in the early 80s, I was into Dungeons and Dragons and computers and video games and things that it wasn't like it is now.
How interesting you converted that into that was a sentinel part of your career.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's when my career changed, is when I stopped chasing what I thought other people in the business wanted me to be and trying to fit into other jobs and saying, like, I'm not even going to audition for this other kind of stuff. I only like these things, and I'm only going to pursue these things because they make me happy. Because we spend so much of our lives chasing things that we think will make us happy instead of just being happy or doing things that or just
make you happy.
It's the idea of make as opposed to just being.
And what's interesting to me is that being the nerd is what got you bullied and then made you successful.
But that, which is kind of a nice payback for all the shit that I went through when I was a kid. So having gone through that, having, you know, getting stuffed in a trash can because I was on my way to chess club and getting, you know, like kicked around. And I was a very small kid.
Chess.
Woof. I had to do PE with the grades that were younger than me. Yeah, it was like that kind of thing. So, you know, so I'm sure there's a lot of defense mechanism because
that's
of that.
That's the comedy, everybody. There it is.
And I have to tell you, I'm so thankful that I grew up that way because it, to me, I think forced me to be introspective at a young age.
Yeah.
And I think kids who are very popular at a young age don't ever learn to go beyond themselves in that way. And so they, like, it's crazy.
Although a lot of people that had harsh childhoods use comedy a little bit like a sword. I think a Corolla doing that. I think Ralphie May kind of did that.
Sure, sure.
Did you ever use it as a... I don't think you do, though. You don't ever, I don't ever hear you using it.
I don't like to attack. Yeah. Like, I, you know, and times, of course, every comic kind of goes through a little bit of that phase. But
sometimes it's the word killing. I go out and I killed.
Right.
I sometimes think that for some comedians, there's like a real aggressive meaning.
Well, there's
in
definitely
that.
A dragon that they're slaying.
Exactly.
But I remember like when I was doing Chelsea Lately all the time, at a certain point, I started to feel really bad because I was just talking shit about people that I didn't really know.
No, I know that's not you.
And Whitney Cummings gave me amazing advice where I said, I feel so guilty. And she goes, you know what? When I feel that way, I just put the joke on myself. And I was like, you're brilliant. Of course, I should be putting the joke on myself, not on other people. And so I don't like to use humor to make other people feel bad.
Oh, no.
It's just not me. And so,
I know that's not you. There's nothing about you unkind. Yeah. That's what I know about
But
you.
I definitely think that with comedy, there's some like, look at me, give me attention. If I get attention, I'll get validation. If I get validation, I'm worth something. If I get, you know, and so it's sort of learning to do comedy because it's learning to do anything because it's fun and because you choose to, not because you need to. And that's a very subtle, but I think profound distinction.
Well, that's where the therapy kicked in.
That's where the therapy. Love therapy and I recommend it
all
the time.
I'm going to undo it right now.
Oh,
all those
shit.
Years of therapy.
Oh my
I'm
gosh.
Going to undo it. And I love our studio here. We either go from an ice box where I have to wear a parka to an oven where I'm literally drenched in sweat. It's awesome.
Are you hot? Do we need to turn on the AC?
Please.
Yeah, we could do that.
Begging you.
And then we'll just be shivering here.
I know. And then in 2 seconds, we'll be back to wearing our...
Yeah.
Okay. Should I continue or wait for the AC? Oh, that's how easy it is to turn on the AC. All right.
Well, we'll know if the turkey pops up right here. If the turkey's done right there.
There you go. Look for it.
Yeah.
So here we go. A couple pieces of business. There's a new t-shirt available on merchmethod.com/TomSegura. Merch Method, M-E-R-C-H, method.com/TomSegura.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen this yet, Drew?
No. Don't show it to me. Don't show it to me.
That's just sound advice.
Because I figured if I saw it, I would not be prone to promote it. And now, lo and behold.
That's a thing you said.
Evidently.
Yeah.
I mean, it's by the quotes.
It's good advice. Like, you should not prolapse your anus. You just shouldn't.
No,
it's not a good idea.
It's not something you should, I think my actual quote was, it's not something you should wish or want to do.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Please.
Because I had a bit of my act where, like, you know, because I talk to people a lot in my set. It's just more fun for me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, 30% of my set is just riffing with the audience. And and for what, there's almost always a nurse in the audience.
Yes.
And so I always ask the question, what's the weirdest thing you've ever pulled out of someone's butt?
Sure.
Because
they always
have such a casual answer to it. Because to them, and I think nurses deserve so much respect for what they do.
Yep.
You know, they do the jobs to keep people alive that no one else would do.
And they get literally crapped on for it, and they get very little in return.
And so I always want to celebrate them because of what they have to do.
100%.
But at a show the other night in Portland, a woman said, well, it wasn't an anus, but someone put a battery-sized dildo in their urethra.
Ooh.
And I could not understand... I mean, I couldn't...
I think she means AA battery.
A AA battery?
Yeah.
But...
I don't think she means a D.
Not a 9 volt?
Although there
not
is...
Not a D in the D?
Oh, Chris, you're onto something here. Okay, gentlemen, I want you to show pictures. I want you to go out and get on your internet and look up sounding. Sounding devices, and then show Chris what a sounding is. And there are people that do sounding.
So what... I don't understand, nor will I ever, and I'm thankful that I don't, but what could possibly be... The joy behind putting something in your urethra,
this is what they do. They put these things inside their urethra. There's all graduated devices. No, there's whole like sounding equipment and things for
why
put sexual deviant sounding.
But I don't understand why. Your show's search history must be on some list somewhere.
Well, it's not my search list. It's those guys in the background there.
But so
there
what,
you
oh,
go.
Why would you
there
do
you
that?
Go. There you
why
go.
Why would a person do that?
There you go.
Why and would a then, person
oh, there
do
it
that?
Is. There it is. No. What are you doing? The second picture there was the one.
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay.
I mean, my stepfather explained having to get a cystoscopy once, and he said it was the most excruciating experience of his life.
There it is. And that's what they used to do. They used to use rigid cystoscopes like that. Now they have flexible ones, so it's not so bad.
You can't show it.
It's so Pac-Man.
But they masturbate and stuff with that thing down there, urethra.
No, thanks.
You can't show that? That's a medical
all good.
Thing.
It's I'm all good. I'm fine with good old-fashioned...
The producers of the show...
Non-pee-hole stretching masturbation.
They're judgmental. They're judging people's sexual proclivities.
There's just so much extra work for us in post now. We have to blur so much shit.
I know, but it just... Like, the picture that I just saw looked like a baby pterodactyl being fed. I don't need... That's why would... Like, I can't imagine what the pleasure in that would be.
Feeding a pelican. I think that's
why,
a good...
Why,
that's a
why,
good
would
way.
Why would that be pleasurable?
Because I don't know. but it, I guess, stimulates the urethra and the prostate. And I guess... Look, to me... If you need that to stimulate yourself, I would look into it. That's all I'm saying.
There's actually some other stuff that we saw that could possibly stimulate some other stuff.
Oh, stop it. That would be me during a sounding. But the only thing I like about that picture is because it would qualify me. Hang on. No, not that picture. That picture would qualify me for Tom Segura as a cool guy.
Yeah,
if that were real, Tom would say I was a cool guy.
If that were real,
and I was one of the many cool guys that he gets in contact with out there in the world.
The only thing I can't forgive in that picture is the blanket hanging on the wall in the background. That tapestry does not go with that room. That's not. Look at that. Come on. What are you in the Southwest?
Now I know that you guys photoshopped all this, and you're complaining about having to X off the edges of a penis?
This is a work of art.
Somebody did. All right, well, send us the sounding pictures so the producers can put up the sounding pictures without having to blur out too much stuff. Right, spend the time blurring things out. Now back to the program. Now let's get to our clips. This is the part that will undo your years of therapy, Chris. This is called, and I don't see these clips beforehand. I have no idea what's coming. This is called Pony Play Girl.
Oh. Yeah, let me give you a little bit of setup to this.
Oh, please do.
So this, a little bit like from the Red Band episode when we looked into pup play.
Yes.
Where they were trying to hide their sexuality between, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
This takes a slightly different angle that we would love your insight on, Dr. Drew.
Oh, my
Drew.
God.
My name is Nicole, and I am addicted to pony play.
Oh, this stuff makes me, this drives me crazy.
Pony play allows me to indulge in the pretend play that all of us came to know and love as a child, and it's kind of taboo as an adult.
So far, so good. This is all pretty normal stuff,
Do you have a male that does this?
This doesn't bother me at all because it does...
Not yet. It gets very weird.
I know, but this isn't hurting anybody. Okay.
I know. But is there... When men do this kind of stuff, it goes sideways. So do you have any males that do the pony play thing? Are we going to see males in this video?
We're not going to see males in this one, but I mean, I don't want to give away.
Okay, keep going. Keep going. All right.
So Nicole has recently decided to become more open about her addiction to pony play. Her first step is telling her aunt Val.
Val's going to have a heart attack.
Hey, Val
just choked on her iced tea.
Did she look into it?
Val does not seem... Val has made a micro-judgment.
Microaggression, I'd say.
Microaggression. Yes. Yeah, there's a... Her body language does not seem open to what's about to happen.
Okay, good.
All right.
Wow. When Nicole came around the corner, I was thinking, holy cow. Holy horse. I thought it looked pretty ridiculous.
You know, I'm into role play. This is basically just the next step in the evolution for me.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
So I gotta say, I'm
close relationship with her aunt, huh?
I have to say, I'm proud of Nicole. It's not easy to do that.
Well, and I would argue it's not off furry.
Pretty close.
Yeah, same thing. So I'm not yet... I'm going to tell you, because I know where this goes, where men do it. I know where this can go, and I'll tell you after we see where she takes it.
Okay.
I just wanted you to be aware that this is kind of what I do, and it's part of my life.
It's like looking at the Joker. Wow.
When I'm actually engaging in it, I wear a bit as well. These are real stainless steel bits that are designed for
horses. Does she need a partner for this?
Like a mind bend. Wow.
I probably will need your help a little bit getting this on.
Can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm going to have to move.
I mean, Val's
kind of looks like the sounding device. You
it does a bit, I must say.
I think Val is handling this very well.
Yes, yes. I would blame the TV cameras for that.
Looks like a torture chamber, Nicole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, now what?
I'll tell you the different gait. The Spanish walk, which is a high step. There's also a trot.
There I go again.
I mean, I have to say, I mean, again, you know, coming from a background of going to like conventions, cons for so many years, like I just see a lot of cosplay. It just doesn't register as weird to me. It's like, oh, well, people like to dress up.
But here's the question, which is why does she need to let her aunt know what, you know, what gets her off? I mean, this is something that I feel like is best.
Does she tell her that?
Well, I mean, I feel like that's kind of...
But don't you think everyone has an inherent need to be accepted? Like, everyone wants to, like, be accepted for what they're into and what they do. I think it's very... It makes nothing to me seems weird. This makes a lot of sense that she would want to tell her aunt so she doesn't have to hide it.
But I don't... That's I need to... Impressive. Unfortunately, this is a TLC show, and we need a more YMH sort of version of this, where we find out what she really is doing.
I can pull up the pup play clips again.
No. I'm just telling you, she's up to something. This is the superficial gloss of what she's doing. There's a weird sexual fetish behind this. And I'll tell you where I came across this. We were on Loveline interviewing some dominatrixes, and they go, oh yeah, we're down the street here. We have this place, and we have a paddock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, paddock?
Did you say that doesn't sound stable? Hey, everybody.
And they go, yes, we have a paddock with Cinderella's coach that men get set up to like this. They put butt plugs in with the tail coming out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they pull Cinderella's castle, Cinderella's whatever, with the mane and the thing on the head and all the stuff that you're seeing here. And the guys get off on that.
Well,
and the women sit up on the Cinderella's pumpkin carriage and whip him while he's doing his thing.
You know, it takes all types, and I don't
cannot judge Chris Hardwick.
Well, in that case, again, it's like they're, you know, like they're all doing the same stuff. I still don't see. I mean, listen,
I am not judging. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying, that if you are the CEO of a company and in your free time you pull Cinderella's carriage, I'd look into it. Would a little cognitive behavioral therapy be a good idea?
I would. Yeah. If it were me and I had those proclivities, I would probably be asking questions about it.
Asking questions.
But it's also like, I just all like to judge. You know, as long as they're not hurting anybody, it doesn't bother me.
We do not sit in judgment, but we're just saying when you're a cool guy, you might want to look into it. Just I'm just saying, just in case. All right, let's move on.
That's
to
a very progressive outlook from both of you. This is a very progressive.
Well, my thing is, I don't judge people. I just react to them, and then I try to understand them. That's all. And she did not induce any shame in me because she didn't tell us what really is going on here, and I don't really want to know. So it's all good. This is Tom and Christina's pet peeves, right?
Right. So now we have a couple talking points lined up from I believe it's episode 485 from your mom's house.
All right.
And these are people that Tom and Christina think should be put to death.
Oh. I didn't know they went so far.
Oh, yeah. They have very experience.
Well, Christina, we discovered, was a psychopath, right? We did discover that during my interview with her. She doesn't understand feelings.
Really?
She doesn't understand feelings. And that is a... Get the clip. It's the clip is available. She would, you know, that would sort of make her, she go, I see people crying in movies. I don't understand why they have emotions, why they cry, what those are. Yeah, I know. Funny, except it isn't. Go ahead. Let's see what they're wanting to, she may really want to kill somebody. That's what I'm saying. I'd be very careful here.
And also, I fucking hate when you're sitting on the airplane and then the guy next to you has shaky leg.
Yeah. I grab someone's leg.
Shut up.
Yeah.
I've dreamt of doing that.
I grab someone's leg.
I've dreamt. And
it was
a stranger.
Yeah. It was the seat behind me and he was doing his tap, 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 tap. And but then he started to pick it up. He was clearly running through a song in his head. And I just reached around and grabbed it.
Yeah. Shut up.
I swear to God.
What did he do?
He goes, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
So that's the first scenario. Who's the psycho in that situation?
My pet peeve is guys that assault other people in the seats behind them.
Oh,
that would be
my
pet peeve.
Well, I don't, I mean, like,
and that would be Tom Segura. I'd say grabbing somebody's leg, he's like he didn't get arrested.
It wouldn't bother me if someone was shaking their leg, but if they were banging the seat,
yeah.
Then that would drive me crazy.
I did that once to somebody, and I feel guilty this year. It was like 20 years ago, and I still feel guilty about it.
Do you need to talk?
I was on a flight to England in a crappy, cramped seat, and I kept putting my knees up on the guy in front of me, and I didn't realize it was pushing through.
And
I was having a good time, like trying to get my back straight and pushing the knees for, let's see, the flight was 9 hours.
Yeah.
7 hours I was doing that. And finally he was like, spoke up. I'm like, oh my God, I feel so bad.
What the fuck, mate? What are you doing? What are you doing over here? What's all this then?
God.
What's all this then?
So, and what's up with Christina? Somebody's not allowed to be anxious. My legs are moving right now. You know what I mean? I'm anxious. I drink a lot of caffeine. My legs move. I like that.
That's the caffeine. I'm curious about the caffeine. Like,
dummy.
Because I can't really, I mean, I can't put anything in my body because I'm so hypersensitive to anything that I can only have just a smidge of caffeine in the morning.
Yeah.
But around the year 2001, 2002, I was having horrible panic attacks and I noticed that I was getting them after I would have a cup of coffee.
Oh.
And it seems so obvious now, but I went on Google and I was like, does caffeine cause panic attacks? And it's like a million pages came up. So
I think substances are more involved with panic than we realize. Cannabis, CBD, alcohol, caffeine all can trigger panic. And panic is a funny thing. It's sort of a learned thing. Once it happens, it's on. You can't undo that.
I have a weird theory about addiction, which I'm not, and not that I'm saying that I think that it is a sentient being, but were it a sentient being, it sort of reminds me of, there's that parasite that like takes over like a slug or a snail and it kind of swells up its head and then it attracts a bird and the bird eats it and the bird shits out the thing and then more parasites spread.
Yes.
I almost feel like one of the things that addiction will do is get your brain to find things to be anxious about so that you will medicate.
Oh,
like that your addiction
100%
tries to force you.
Yes.
And
your addiction, here's what your addiction does. We'll use anything to get you to keep using.
That's right.
And negativity, negative thinking, reacting negatively to people, anxiety, sleeplessness, all great reasons to use.
Because
happiness, celebration, also great reasons to use.
It's about not, for me, I realize it was about not wanting to have responsibility for any emotion, good or bad.
Mm.
But
responsibility or just have them,
yeah. like own them, have to deal with them.
Yeah, have and to I think, deal with them, right.
And I think, you know, like your brain is sort of like a radar screen or the addictive brain is like a radar screen and you can have a perfectly fine interaction with someone and you go home and then your brain's going beep, beep, yeah. boop. And you go, wait a minute. I said this one thing.
Yeah.
Do you think they took it this way? Oh my God. If they take it this way, then that means this. And this means this. And oh my God. Yeah. And it just like your brain keeps finding more and more things to send you into the panic.
And the thing about that disease, it enlists other people in it.
Right.
Right. So when I'm treating alcoholic addict, I always have to be very, very careful because I'll get involved with, yeah, but your mom, she was terrible to you. Was that trauma awful? And I'll walk out and Bob Forrest, you know, I worked with the guy with the hat and the glasses.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell him, like, oh my God, I just talked to Chris and we had this great experience about his dad and the loss and the unresolved grief. And Bob will go, yeah, he wants to get high. He sees that you can prescribe to him and he wants you to prescribe. He wants to get high. That's it.
Oh,
what do you think this is? I'm like, oh, God,
shit.
I have to always remember it's always about the drugs, always
so
about the
alcohol. So what is that the brain does? Like, why do we catastrophize? Like,
because I think about it this way, that the motivation, it's a broken motivation.
Mm-hmm.
It's your survival system tweaked, so it's pointing in the wrong direction, and it's using everything your brain has to satisfy it.
Right.
And so everything your brain has falls victim to this very low primitive motivation.
But why would your body want to put you into a state of distress?
It's a disorder. That's why it's a disorder.
It's so interesting.
It is very interesting.
It's so interesting.
What else they got for pet peeves for us?
Okay, here comes the next clip.
I mean, the only thing worse than a foot tap and leg shaker.
Yeah. Fucking Whistler. I hate public Whistlers. Yeah. I hate it.
Hold on. I feel like there's almost nothing Tom could say, and Christina's not going to say, I hate that guy. I hate them.
You know, I don't mind public whistling so much, but I do have a pet peeve with, I was sitting on a plane and there was a dude just talking on a speakerphone. And when he was done talking on a speakerphone, he just turned his iTunes on with no headphones. Now, granted, maybe he lost his headphones,
yeah.
but still to the point where you're inflicting your stuff on other people. That's what drives me crazy.
Now, hang on. I'm actually taking a picture of this screen. Everyone's got to take a screenshot of this Christina pic, because this is what you need to watch out for. If you didn't think she was a psychopath before, everybody...
You know what? That's not fair, Drew. That's just an unfortunate... pause face. Everyone's got a pause face.
A meme out of this pause face. This is psychopath face. All right. Is there anything else?
Let's move. Red.
All right. What else they got? What else they not like?
All right. So those are the Whistlers.
Yeah. There are other things, I'm sure.
The last type of people that annoy them.
It just astounds me how people behave in public.
You were telling me about... It reminded me so much of that time we were at the movies.
Yeah.
And there's a guy sitting right behind me, and for the duration of a 90-minute film, he had a toothpick in his mouth, and he would go,
oh my God.
That would be infuriating.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Like on a four-second cycle.
Yeah.
I like the way Tom accumulates like a list of people that he hates.
Well,
he's walking around accumulating.
Sounds like a lot of people.
That's what I'm saying.
The public.
It's generally, he finds people, he finds something in everybody, and yet
that is irritating.
The actual horrible people, he calls cool people.
So
explain that to me.
So do you think none of this is justified in their hatred towards these people?
I think all of it's justified. but I think that there's no end to this list when it comes to those two. Who knows where this will stop?
Well, that's the end of this list for now.
For now, anything for us? Any weird pet peeves we have?
Well, there's one, but I don't entirely blame the people for it. But like if I'm having lunch somewhere, like there's this place I go for breakfast a lot, and the seating is like there's this long bench that's all like one long bench up against the wall. And sometimes, so whatever people are doing on the other side of the bench, you can feel. And sometimes someone will come in and they have a kid who's like 5 or 6 years old.
Oh, yeah.
And the kid's just like doing their foot against the thing, and it shakes the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the parent seems completely oblivious, and it's almost like, do you not care, or do you just not notice it?
You haven't had kids yet, huh?
But
you're going to understand that the kids so overwhelm your systems
that
you stop picking up on things you should pick up.
I don't blame the parents. I just feel like, I just always think like, well, you're overwhelmed. I mean,
they would happily stop if they were aware of it, but they have to screen it out.
They have to, because otherwise there'd just be too many things that they would notice that. Understood.
They're in survival mode, trust me.
Yeah.
Pet peeves for me. God, I have so many. Most of my things are, you know, people. Oh, One thing that drives me crazy is when people go, I'm so...
I'll get it.
There goes sweaty pits. I'm so concerned about my son. I'm so concerned about him. I'll do anything. And I give them some specific direction. They go, yeah, okay. Well, now what do I need to do? I go, I'm telling you, this is what...
I just told you.
Yeah. What else can I do? It's like, there's the one thing. You said you'd do anything. And the one thing I tell you to do that will make a difference, you don't do. Tells me everything I need to know.
Yeah, that is pretty... I mean, in general, for me, it's sort of like what they were saying. It's just, it's people who are kind of force other people to deal with them in public in a non-aware, very selfish way, you know?
Yeah, and there's got to be lots of things like that out there.
There are a lot of things
worry,
like that.
Don't worry, Tom and Christina will
continue
to...
Yeah, they'll figure it out. And Christina will hunt them down, by your definition.
Yeah. And look at them with that face, and God knows what might happen. Now back to the show. Here are some emails. This is called Sweaty Pits. I've been on a regular nutritional rich diet, blah, blah, blah. Boy, people got to learn English. Excessive underarm sweating started. This is on this certain diet he's on, I guess. As of the last few months, my armpits have been extremely sweaty without doing anything. I'll just sit there and feel the sweat dripping down my sides and have soaked t-shirts. Of course, I know the difference between antiperspirant and deodorant. I've tried them both and the clinical strength stuff and nothing has helped. That sucks. I've heard several remedies, including Botox for underarms. That does work. I don't know about all that, but there's some real ideas behind that. Just regularly try not to sweat so much.
It'd be interesting if he told you. I feel like it's probably like a keto diet or something.
I think you're right. But this is why this email is being read, because he signs off it as piss on me and beat me.
Ding, ding, ding.
I know you guys. I know how you work.
he really did sign it that way. Yes, that could also be a joke.
All I know is that comes from them.
It's a reference to your mom's house.
I'm sure. Oh, gotcha. Okay, great.
420, you will see the piss on me and beat me guy.
Okay,
Can I review that video at some point?
Yeah, sure. We'll get it prepped for one of these episodes.
Thank you.
Joel from Minnesota.
So there are, Botox does some work, but it's more for the forehead, things like that. There also are these stellate ganglion blocks, these kinds of things. They can go in and clip the sympathetic ganglions in here.
Is it good to prevent you from sweating, though? Like, isn't your body supposed to? But not excessively.
Yeah, it's controversial. But hand sweating is the most troubling thing. And they can't pick up a piece of paper.
Right.
And the neck stellate ganglion blocks work really, really well for that. I think they do it along the thoracic.
Wait, speaking of diet stuff, I had asked you something before, and you said, ask me on the show, because... The fun thing about science is that it's a never-ending process of discovery. And so one year they might say, this thing is bad for you. And the next year they might say, it's not bad for you. And then it's bad for you again. Right. Now I was just reading, there's a whole new study on eggs.
Right.
I eat egg whites every morning. Yes. I also have high cholesterol.
Right.
And so it said, obviously I imagine that's with the yolk. Mm-hmm. However, you said you had some thoughts on that.
Well,
I was curious about
it. The study shows that if you eat more than 3 eggs a week or something, you die young.
Right.
It was something crazy like that.
Yeah.
I can tell you there's something wrong with that study. Now, here's the thing about science. There is no such thing as truth in science. It does not exist. There is... attempts to make an approximation of truth by disproving previous studies. We're constantly disproving. That's the project of science is disproving previous sort of...
So we have to disprove that it's bad to prolapse your anus, right? Someday it'll be good to prolapse your anus?
Don't think you need to disprove that
all right,
one,
I'm not
but
trying
you're
to,
certainly okay. welcome to try.
I don't. I'm well, fine.
Sounding might be good too someday. I'm just saying. So it's a disproving process. So for media outlets to run headlines because one study showed something that is beyond irresponsible.
True, it's almost like you're saying that the internet is based on clickbaity headlines to get traffic of articles that people won't actually read or research.
And I don't blame the internet on that. What I blame is these news outlets that do the same thing. It should not, I remember when I was a resident, I would stand in the patient's rooms and hear the morning television shows going, and they'd run some medical story. I'm like, I can't believe they're running that. That is just a recent publication that may or may not turn out
to be
true.
But you're also talking about people who are not medical professionals who are just grabbing
things
that sound.
This is why they should not run these things until they become axioms and standards of care and standard practices. And even then, there's a probability we'll disprove these things. That's just how it works.
Okay.
So the egg thing, I'm going to say, is completely bogus.
Mm-hmm.
Avoiding egg yolks if you have high cholesterol, of course.
Sure.
If you're trying to bring your cholesterol down. But egg whites, best source of protein you can possibly come
upon. Great. Love it.
So there's something wrong with that study. So that's why. So now somebody's got to do another study to figure out, what is that? What did we actually come up with? What was flawed about that study? Speaking of flawed, stretching your dong. Loving the show so far. Keep up the good work.
You mean like stretching it before a workout or after a run?
We'll see.
Okay.
I had a question about natural penis enlargement. I'm 28 years old. Would you hear about that big billionaire that died on the table getting his penis enlarged?
No.
Yeah, that happened recently.
What?
In Europe. I don't remember. I just saw it as a headline that seemed
were they putting like a stack of gold coins in it?
Typically they do this thing where they break the suspensory ligament and they pull it forward. You actually have to wear weights on your penis.
A lot
for
of
a
dong trauma
afterwards.
In this episode. A lot of dong trauma.
And they pull down the skin of the penis and then they sew in cadaver tissue and then they pull up the skin again. So you get length and girth.
That's my God. So there's like dead person penis in your penis?
My penis is fairly average size, roughly 5.5 inches. I've seen videos and done research about penis enlargement that doesn't have anything to do with consuming pills. What I found is that a series of somewhat gentle stretches over a series of several months that penis growth can happen over time. It consists of grabbing the base of your flaccid penis with one hand. This has a name. I forget what it's called. Someone's going to look at a penis growth grabbing and pulling. Pressure and running up to the tip for about 7 seconds at a time, repeating it about 20 times.
It's not called taffying?
It's essentially turning your penis into a piece of taffy. That's exactly, it should be called taffying. Thank you, Chris
If
Hardwick.
I put cadaver tissue into my penis, is it going to want to eat brains all the time?
Here's the thing. I'm telling you, are you going to do another Walking Dead thing coming up?
We're going to do a Walking Dog.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying. Don't have me on that. Who knows where it will go. Let's see, exercise, penis size stretching. What does it say the name of it is? It's got a name. It's got a name like felching or something. It's got a crazy name like that.
I think there's a consumption element in felching if my grade school.
No, I know. It's
Urban
not
dictionary.
No. Well, no. Peyronie's disease is the curvature. You do not treat Peyronie's disease. Jelking, that's what it's called. Jelking? See, I told you like Fletch felching.
Josh Potter, the expert, just told us.
Thank you. Jelking.
That sounds like something in like a Dr. Scholl product.
None of this stuff really works. I mean, maybe you get a quarter inch or something, but think about it. What you want to enlarge are the cavernous bodies that are inside the penis, not the soft tissue around the cavernous bodies. And those things can't really be enlarged. You know what I mean? Maybe a little stretch on them. That's about it. Your penis has these two spongy.
Someone's going to freeze frame that and Photoshop the shit out of what
I'm
you were
do
just
it this
doing.
Way.
Yeah, exactly.
Spongy device.
You're just
here.
Giving them ammo, Drew.
Trust me, they use.
You were
Chris.
Just making a face, and they put a picture. But if you're, if you're double fisting in front of your mouth, what do you think's going to happen?
Here it goes. Do not double anal. But where was I? So yes. These things don't enlarge really. The cavernous bodies and. You can maybe stretch them a little bit, but you're not really going to, and it's not going to really do
And the
anything.
Surgery is dangerous? Like a guy died?
Yeah, there are people doing... did you see the documentary about John Wayne...
No.
The guy that got his penis cut off by his wife?
John Bobbitt?
Johnny Bobbitt.
No, I didn't see the documentary.
It's a really good documentary about the wife and really what she's doing now. It's called Lorena, I think, Lorena Bobbitt.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't realize, had a penis enlargement years after his penis got reattached.
Oh.
And that got botched. And that doctor who said he did 1,500 of them or something lost his license. So
God, that guy just had a rough go with
somebody.
His...
We did a show on Discovery Health years ago, and I scrubbed in on one of those enlargement procedures just to see what he was doing. Learn to use what you got. That's all I'm saying.
It doesn't sound awesome.
It is not awesome. Not awesome. Dating a formerly dead fetus.
I'm not even sure how to wrap my brain around that sentence.
You're the one that does Walking Dead. I'm a 30-year-old woman. I recently got serious with a great guy and fell for him fast. He's incredibly sweet and phenomenal in bed. A few conversations about emotions, politics, relationships, and other. I started to feel something wasn't quite common. His rational thought patterns didn't make sense to me, and frankly, I got annoyed at his inability to think critically. He shared with me about 5 months of dating that he was born dead and resuscitated at birth. While it's a miracle, he's with us, and he's a lovely human. I feel like he's disabled. I've tried to give him a little guidance in some ways. We'll never bring up the oxygen deprivation. And he's incredibly resistant. I feel like he's capped or like he's reached his capacity. I like this guy. I wish I could go somewhere. Can you please weigh in? He wants to be together. I think we are amazing, but I still feel confused.
Okay, so that headline, I think we have to admit, is a little clickbaity. Because that's not where I thought that was going. I was prepared for a woman with like a prune in a jar. And I'm pre-horrified. And it just sounds like... This doesn't sound like what I thought that was going to be.
So it's traumatic birth.
Yes.
And it's some sort of brain injury, something. It may or may not have something to do with what she's complaining about.
Sure.
I imagine he's in his 30s as well. If I were him, I would want to be tested myself.
Sure.
If you can get tested and see what, if there are any disabilities, and realize there are lots of treatments for these things. Lots and lots and lots.
And also maybe don't refer to him as a formerly dead fetus. That might not be helping the relationship.
I'm just saying. I don't know that he would like that.
I guess you would just have to, yeah, you're right. He should, I mean, did it say she can talk to him about it or can't talk to him about it?
He puts it off. He seems dismissive.
Well, you can't make
it. But he's a cool guy and he sounds like a great guy, but he feels disabled. So I would want to know what the disability was and see what we could do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to define it first. And when you have things like this, you have to do what's called neuropsych testing. It's like a 2-day testing process. It's a little bit expensive. Insurance should pay for it if you have a high suspicion that something's there. And let's get that done. Even if they do an abbreviated version of it, you might get a sense of what is going on there. Do we have any voice messages?
We sure do.
Oh, boy. Right, cool people, Chris. Here comes some cool
people. I can't
people.
Wait.
Oh, boy.
Hello, Dr. Drew, longtime listener of the Mommies. Listen, I've got a weird problem. My wife and I, we've been together 11 years. Anytime we have sex and I have consumed alcoholic beverages prior to sex, when I, for lack of a better term, come, I get burning in my urethra and my penis. I usually have to sit down on the toilet and pee and pee and pee. It feels like a bladder infection. I'm not sure what's happening. Maybe you can explain that. And if you have any remedies, I'd love to hear them.
Okay. I like way he has a lack of a better term.
For lack of a better term, here's the exact term.
I can either say ejaculate or cum, whatever. So here's the deal. Alcohol is an irritant to the urethral tract, the urogenital tract. It irritates, particularly, if I remember right, beer does especially. This guy sounds kind of like a beer dude, so I'm imagining he's consuming a little bit of beer. And it's irritating. And, after sexual activity, that's also irritating. So just, I think you're just adding up sort of one irritant.
But instead of it feels like he has a bladder infection, is the prostate involved in that process at all?
It kind of can be, but really it's the urethra. It's a urethritis of sorts.
Well, I hope he's not sounding. Maybe that would open up.
Or maybe that would explain why things hurt.
That could explain that too.
Because I don't know how you can sound without getting urethritis.
Oh yeah, there's a thermometer in my dick. I forgot to mention. Should I not have that in there? I just wasn't. That's what I always used to love about doing Loveline, is that someone, I broke him. You know,
I'm so happy. I'm just happy because I not had my hands over my face all show. And I thought, what's wrong with the show today? Here we go. I feel better.
Oh, I forgot to mention.
Okay.
If I put a funnel on my dick hole and I pour hot sauce in there, that's not good, right?
No,
not
good.
I was going to mention that, but
I didn't
know if it was relevant.
Thank you,
it's
Chris.
It's the things people don't know that are, like, the things that are always the things that they don't know if they're relevant or not.
NBC thing. You need to know.
The more you know.
The more you know. You were asking about Loveline. You were saying.
I was just saying like that. The thing that this is what I just said, where people, the thing that they always ask if is relevant is usually the most relevant thing.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Or I have to take them in an entirely different path.
Right.
All right. Let's do one more voice message and then wrap this thing up. Here we go.
Sounds good. Here it comes.
Hi, Dr. Drew. My name is Dakota, 24 years old. I was wondering if it's ever common for adult males to have wet dreams. Thanks.
Of course. As we used to say on Loveline back in the day, if the fluid is not removed by you or sexual activity, God will remove it at night. That's just the way it goes.
I don't want to think about it.
God will make sure it leaves your body. That's the natural, that's how your body works. I mean, the seminal vesicles fill up and
with a gray beard and robes who puts on a glove made of clouds. And then
whatever he has to do, he gets the job done. It is nature. It is whatever.
Nature will do that for you.
However, nature will, you don't like that. God in the process, nature will do it for you. That's
yeah,
right. Chris, it's such a privilege, man.
Oh,
it's,
man, you too. I love it. I adore you.
I loved it.
This is great. I'm so glad you're doing this show. And if this feels really good, this just makes me feel like the old days, man.
It's a little Loveline-esque, and it's sort of a reboot and sort of a new way of doing it.
Well, I know it's also helpful for people, and I just I appreciate what you do. I really do.
Well, and it's something that's, you know, you kind of feel like we don't need to do this anymore because of the internet, but lo and behold, we do.
But there's a lot of bad information out there, and you can't, especially anxious people, do not self-diagnose via the internet.
No,
it's the worst thing you can do. And so But also, I do think it's important to talk about these things and normalize them and let people feel okay and let them feel comfortable that they can get help and get therapy or seek medical attention.
Horseplay and pulling the Cinderella's wagon. All these things are important to talk about. Thank you for bringing it up, Chris. And what do you call it? Walking dong?
Walking dong.
Walking dong. We'll have coming soon to
literally,
to AMC
literally, or literally. Yeah, so. Literally.
What else you got going on? Tell me what we where should find you.
The podcast, ID10T, podcast, ID10T.com. And then also I'm doing a bunch of stand-up dates. I'll be in Phoenix at the end of March and Denver in April.
It's
and,
on your website?
It'll be on the website.
The website is?
ID10T.com, yeah.
ID10T.com. And don't forget to send us your voice messages at 818-253-1693 and email us at drafterdark@gmail.com. Whatever you like about the show, you don't like about the show, and your questions. You can be dating a formerly dead fetus and have a question about it. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Chris. We'll see you next
Drew.
Time.
Thanks.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation of the Dr. Drew After Dark podcast or interaction on the DrDrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or physician medical advice or direction per se. You must always follow your medical professional's advice and direction. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Please understand, I am not playing the role of physician in this environment per se. I'm educating. I am a licensed physician with specialty boards in American Board of Internal Medicine and American Board of Addiction Medicine.